Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, a breakthrough in gene editing. Scientists in the U.S. have now successfully edited human embryos to correct a defect that causes a genetic heart condition. It can cause sudden cardiac arrest in athletes who drop dead on the field. There's been so much talk about the gene-splitting tool, splicing tool, CRISPR, and yes, it was used here. We want to know how far we've come, how far this goes. What sort of human life gets designed, born? This hour on Point, the tough medical and ethical questions surrounding gene editing. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. If you could stop a disease in its tracks before birth with genetic editing, would you? Or does this open a Pandora's box, a form of playing God, designer babies, enhancements for the rich? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later this hour, the fight over the right to sue nursing homes for mistreatment. But first, gene editing. Joining me via Skype from Needham, Massachusetts, is Amy Doxer-Marcus, health and science reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Amy, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
What's the first here?
The first is that it's the first reported time that this has taken place in the United States. It's also a scientific advance. There have been reported uses of CRISPR to edit human embryos before, but the scientists here really were able to be successful and minimize some problems that had posed challenges in previous studies.
What was the breakthrough on that point?
The breakthrough is that they were able to intervene at an earlier stage, and so they were able to avoid some of the other problems that had plagued the use of CRISPR in embryos. For example, in previous reports, cuts were made in unintended spots of the DNA, which can lead to other health problems, and there were other concerns in previous studies when some but not all of the cells in the embryo were repaired, and the scientists in this paper were able to show a way to overcome or minimize some of those issues.
What's the disease they were working on here, Amy?
They were working on a genetic heart condition called hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, or HCM. It's not a uniformly fatal condition, but it does affect an estimated 1 in 500 people.
And what? This can set you up for sudden death later in life.
It can. It's a condition that doctors believe that they have ways of addressing and controlling it. But yes, some people can suddenly have cardiac death and die.
Exactly who was doing this work, Amy? The research.
The work was being done by a team of researchers at a variety of institutions, including Oregon Health and Science University and the Salk Institute for Biological Studies. Those were two of the leading institutions, but there were other institutions as well.
You've got Korea's Institute for Basic Science also here.
Yes.
There's been work done around the world. Has this been done before elsewhere? China and others have been quite forward-leaning on this front.
Yes, they have. And the previous studies that I mentioned were done by researchers in China. So far, to our knowledge, all the work has been done in the area of research. Nobody has reported trying to create an embryo that they were then going to implant in a woman and try to bring to a full-term pregnancy and the birth of a child.
An embryo requires, of course, an egg and sperm. Where did those come from? What was the setting for this? And what were the inputs, if we can call them that?
So the doctors in Oregon recruited women, healthy women, who donated their eggs. They were compensated for doing that. Oregon permits compensation for that.
Okay.
And they also recruited men who were known to have a genetic mutation that causes this heart condition. In this case, it was one man who served as the sperm donor and a number of women. I believe they used 12 women for the eggs.
So the man had this hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, or HCM, in his gene line.
He does. According to the paper, he has a defibrillator to prevent sudden death, and he also takes medications to control his condition, and he was willing to participate in the research.
So the embryo was created, and then how and when exactly was the gene splicing done, if that's the right verb?
Right. So one of the things that was interesting about this experiment is that the researchers injected the sperm and the CRISPR-Cas9 components that were going to do the gene cutting at the same time in the eggs, into the eggs during fertilization. That was actually an advance and enabled them to do the experiment more successfully.
So in other words, the gene editing and the fertilization happened, I guess, almost simultaneously. What's the significance of that?
Well, it's significant. In this particular case, it was significant because one thing that happened that they were surprised by, they had, at the same time that they were injecting these CRISPR-Cas9 components, they created the healthy DNA that they wanted to use to have the repair be made after the cut. But the embryo decided not to use that synthetic DNA. Instead, the embryo used the mother's healthy copy as the template for making the correction. It was a very interesting and unexpected scientific finding and revealed something interesting about the way embryos do repairs.
That's incredible. In other words, they had designed some a healthy gene sequence to go into that spot, but instead nature reached out and put the mother's genetic code there.
Nature did, and what's interesting about that is the scientists need to do more experiments to understand whether this would happen all the time, or whether sometimes the sequence that they suggest would be taken up. It raised a lot of questions. It's a really exciting and interesting development.
This wasn't just one embryo. It was 58 embryos, and you report that their genetic editing corrected the mutation in 42 out of 58 embryos, or 72% of those embryos corrected the mutation was corrected. Is that considered a good rate, Amy?
Well, it depends on your perspective. It's certainly, according to the scientists I interviewed, they found it incredibly impressive that they were able to get that amount of correction and that amount of embryos. Previous studies didn't use that amount of embryos. So that's, first of all, that's significant. But there are other scientists who say, wow, 72%, that's a great advance. But if you're going to want to use this and, you know, to actually try to create babies, you're going to want to have 100%.
These embryos were never implanted in a woman. So, I mean, obviously they were never born. Could they have been? Were they fully viable?
They were considered viable embryos in the sense that the eggs were high quality eggs that you might use if you were a couple going in to do IVF. And certainly the sperm donor was able to, you know, have children, technically speaking, as well. So, yes, if they had wanted to proceed, these would have been considered viable embryos. But the embryos they did create were created only for research, and they removed the cells within these embryos to try to make sure that the gene correction was being done accurately.
Amy Doxer Marcus with the Wall Street Journal, please stand by. I actually have one of the scientists involved in this research with us right now from Oregon, from Portland, Oregon. Dr. Paula Amato is with us, professor of obstetrics and gynecology at Oregon Health and Science University, one of the co-authors of the study published last week in the journal Nature. She's a reproductive endocrinologist. Dr. Paula Amato, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Good to be with you.
You worked on this. You're in the middle of it. To your mind, what's most important about the research that you've just done and published?
Well, as Amy said, I think we were able to show that theoretically you could correct a gene mutation in viable human embryos. You could do so potentially safely. There were two problems that plagued previous studies that we seemed to improve on or correct. So theoretically, you could prevent a number of genetic diseases from being transmitted to future generations. And I think the other advance, as Amy mentioned, was the mechanism of repair that was also novel.
Speak to what's important about the mechanism.
Well, as Amy mentioned, we introduced an external template. If you think of the word analogy, the cut and paste function, the embryo refused to take the paste and instead used autocorrect.
In other words, the man-made correction, or woman in your case, that was introduced, it didn't pick that up. It took the mother's genetics.
Exactly. So that may have implications. It may not be so easy to change the genetic code in embryos.
Or in other words, just to sort of whip up a new formula that you can put in whatever you like.
Exactly.
This is a heart condition. What other mutations or diseases or conditions that we might have heard of could be addressed in this way?
Theoretically, any genetic disease caused by a single gene mutation. Now, we were able to show that it works in heterozygous conditions when there is one normal copy of the gene and one abnormal copy. We don't think at this point it would work if the embryo had two abnormal copies of the gene.
In other words, if each parent had the disease, is that what you mean?
Yes. If both parents had two abnormal copies of the disease or of the gene, then it would likely not work. Or in an autosomal dominant condition such as this disease, if the man had two abnormal copies of the gene, actually it would work in that case, but pre-implantation genetic diagnosis alone would not be sufficient.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about editing the human embryo, the human genome, to stave off disease and more. It's now been done in the U.S., and we're asking how far this will and should go. Amy Doxer Marcus is with us, health and science reporter for The Wall Street Journal. She's been writing up the latest developments. Dr. Paula Amato is with us, professor of obstetrics, gynecology, Oregon Health and Science University, one of the co-authors of the new study just published last week in the journal Nature, laying out the successful editing of genes in human embryos to repair a common disease-causing mutation. You can join us this hour. How do you feel about editing the genome of human embryos, about editing the unborn for what they will be? Is that great? Is it merciful, a blessing, if they're otherwise facing a lifetime of defect or disease or death sentence? Is it a bridge too far? Is it playing God? October 2014, 16-year-old Miles Kirkland Thomas was a high school football player, Staten Island, New York. He died during morning football practice. He was later diagnosed with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, or HCM, exactly the mutation that this latest research was focused on correcting and did correct in the embryos. He'd been running wind sprints because he was late, you'll hear. Michelle Charlesworth reported for WABC then in New York City.
He collapsed on the field and died at the hospital yesterday morning. They confirm what his family reportedly has said, that Miles had to run wind sprints because he was late to morning practice and that he collapsed soon after. Police say Miles suffered cardiac arrest and passed at 10:45 a.m.
From HCM, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. If his embryo had years earlier been edited in this way, maybe he'd be alive. But there are ethical issues here. Last week when this all came out, AP talked with Dr. Eric Topol, a cardiologist, geneticist at the Scripps Research Institute in La Jolla, California. He talked about the unanswered questions around the editing of the genome of a human embryo.
This is such a big deal to actually manipulate the genome of an embryo. We don't know what happens when that embryo grows into a baby or when that baby grows into an adult. So these are some big unknowns that it'll take years to understand, and we're not really ready for this to get launched. The ethics, the unknowns are really a really big question.
But it's been done already now with HCM, this heart condition, and one of those who wrote the study on it is with us, Dr. Paula Amato. We've got callers right off the bat. Leslie in Marlboro, Massachusetts. Leslie, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call, Tom. I'm literally, my heart is jumping out of my throat because I'm married to a man who has HCM. His dad, who was one of 10 siblings, had the disease. Probably 6 of those siblings had the disease, 4 of whom died of sudden cardiac death. My husband's brother at 32 died of sudden cardiac death. His first cousin at 40 went on the ice to play hockey at Chelsea Piers in New York, died of sudden cardiac death. My husband was the second youngest person in the world to get an internal defibrillator.
Mm-hmm.
We've dealt with this disease in our family. So many of his cousins have it. Everyone has defibrillators. But the weight of knowing that you can have the disease, not know whether or not you will be a victim of sudden cardiac death because there are very few symptoms attached to the disease.
Yeah.
I waited 7 years between children because I didn't want to have another child because every day of their childhood, I worried that they would inherit it when they were able to discover the mutation on the gene that carries the disease. I hit the lottery twice, both my kids in this family with such a horrible history did not inherit this disease. So to hear about this to me is just like a miracle.
And we can see why. Those are big numbers right there in your immediate family, Leslie, and your husband's. Dr. Amato, there in Portland, Oregon, does the research that you're doing offer hope to a family exactly like Leslie's?
It does, and my heart goes out to Leslie and her family, and there are many families afflicted by genetic disease. So theoretically, this could eliminate that gene mutation in her family. Now, of course, it would still require in vitro fertilization, which, as we know, is expensive and not accessible to everybody. And right now, there is the option of actually doing pre-implantation genetic diagnosis to select embryos that do not carry the disease. But we feel that this gene editing technology would enhance PGD by making more healthy embryos available for transfer and potentially reducing the number of IVF cycles a woman would have to undergo to have a healthy baby.
If Leslie and her husband created an embryo and you did this kind of gene editing in that embryo, if the mutation were there and you did this to remove it and replace, would that child, if it was taken to term and born, would it then be free of this? Would that child, when it grew to adulthood, have to worry about passing on this mutation, or would that be out of the line?
It would be out of the line, as you say. That's the implication of germline gene editing. Not only are you preventing the disease in that child, but you're preventing it in that child's future children as well, in all future generations.
Leslie, can you imagine that you would or would have, with your husband, stepped up to have that kind of gene editing done if it could remove this threat of mutation from your family line?
Oh, my gosh, 100%. I mean, we lived for 20-plus years every day worrying about our children because the disease doesn't manifest itself till kids are older. So you worry. I mean, you know, we would argue, don't let them play sports. Let them play sports because, you know, the disease, you know, you're affected by sudden cardiac death upon exertion. And so every day of worry with this cloud, will my child die of sudden cardiac death? We don't know. They're not diagnosed. Will they be diagnosed? And you know, so many of his cousins were diagnosed in their late 20s and early 30s. So, I mean, to us, and of course, now we have so many family members who are, you know, just now trying to get tested to see if their children are carrying this gene. And so many young people who want to have babies, but we all worry about it constantly.
Leslie, you make it very real for us, and I'm very grateful for your call. Thank you very much for that, and good luck to your family. Amy, we heard also from Dr. Eric Topol there from the Scripps Research Institute saying a lot of ethical issues here. Are those heightened in the aftermath of the publication of this story, Amy?
To me, the publication of this story is a reminder that the science is advancing very quickly, and sometimes it advances even more quickly then our opportunity as members of the public to discuss it, to understand it, and to share the perspectives, both the one that Leslie shared, which was very moving, and also the perspective of other people who may feel differently about using this technology versus other ways to try to prevent passing on genetic mutations to children.
Amy Doxer-Marcus with The Wall Street Journal. Thank you very much for being with us today, Amy.
Thank you.
Todd in Oklahoma City. Todd, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, I was wondering, what are the limitations to this? Is it unlimited? Can they change, change their bodies? Can they improve upon their lifespan? Will they be able to make them more intelligent? Well, you know, things like that.
Dr. Amato?
Well, that's a question that often comes up. What about using this technology for enhancement purposes? And I personally, and I think society feels that this technology should not be used for those purposes. But even if someone wanted to do that, it's not so easy. We actually don't know all the genes involved in things like intelligence or athleticism. It's not a single gene. It's likely to be many genes, and we don't know what those genes are. And secondly, if the mechanism of repair holds up in future studies, if you just wanted to put in a better gene, it may not be so easy. The embryo may reject that. So although the concerns are valid and I think we should discuss them, I think that particular concern about using this technology for enhancement purposes at this point is a little overblown.
Are there legal or ethical constraints on that, on research on that front at this point in this country or abroad? Or is it here or abroad? Is it an open opportunity if you look at it that way?
Well, I can speak to the situation in the United States. There are some barriers to this research. It is technically allowed, but federal funds cannot be used. So the National Institutes of Health does not fund embryo research currently. And as well, Congress prohibits the Food and Drug Administration from considering any applications for clinical trials related to this technology. So at least here in the United States, it would be difficult for us to move forward with clinical applications. Not that we're ready to do that at this point.
But I did see that the senior author of your study is pushing clinical trials to involving the transfer of embryos into the womb to produce pregnancy and the birth of healthy children with this.
Yes, ultimately, that's why we're doing this research, to prevent genetic disease. And so ultimately, we would like to do clinical trials, and I would advocate for a change in the United States to allow federal funds to be used for this research, because there's ethical and scientific oversight, and for Congress to change the law that would allow us to proceed. Otherwise, I'm afraid, and I think a lot of people are afraid, that this technology will be used in other countries with perhaps less tight regulations, and there wouldn't be the same amount of regulatory oversight with potentially severe consequences.
Andy in Charlotte, North Carolina. Andy, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Basically, my concerns were pretty much exactly what you were just touching on. The ethical aspect of this almost seems moot. When this technology gets to the point where we can enhance human beings and build stronger soldiers or smarter scientists, to me it seems like an inevitability that somewhere in the world it's going to happen. China, Russia, India, Japan, Korea, somebody's going to do this. And when they do, they're going to begin an arms race. And we inevitably, and everyone in the world, all nations, are going to be pulled into building stronger soldiers and smarter scientists. What prevents that?
Let us look at exactly that, Andy. Dr. Amato, please stand by there in Portland, Oregon, to help us do it. I want to go to Arthur Kaplan, joins us from Ridgefield, Connecticut, professor of bioethics, head of the Division of Medical Ethics at New York University School of Medicine. Arthur Kaplan, welcome back to On Point.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And with us from Oakland, California, Marcy Darnovsky, executive director of the Center for Genetics and Society. Marcy Darnovsky, thank you for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Marcy, first to you, do you see the risk of an arms race here? Somebody breaks through, just as our caller Andy says, in some country somewhere. And then everybody feels like, my gosh, if we don't do this, We got to jump on, you know, we're going to be the last form of humankind, not the future form, and we'll be left behind. Is that a justified concern after the paper last week, or is that getting way ahead of ourselves?
Well, actually, it's upside down, because around the world, almost all countries that have an advanced biomedical or biotech sector have already thought this through, and some years ago have established laws about this technology, and their laws, they draw a line and say, yes, let's use genetic modification techniques to help people who are sick, but we should not use it to try to change the genes of future children and future generations. So that law exists in dozens of countries already. The United States has some agency-level regulations and indirect laws that Paula referred to, but we don't have such a law on our books. And one of the reasons that all those other countries felt that this was the right place to draw the line, that we should not go forward with the kinds of genetic changes that can get passed on, one of the big reasons is because in order to prevent the transmission of inherited diseases like the cardiac disease we're talking about today, mm-hmm. you can use a technique that's been available in fertility clinics for almost 20 years that's proven, that's safe, that raises some of the same ethical questions as genetic manipulation, but to a lesser degree.
You're talking about pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, just
exactly,
scanning
yeah.
before the...
Exactly, referred to it, but we didn't really explain what that was to folks. So Leslie, who's married to a man with HCM, they could have used PGD to have their children, and their family members can do that today.
We get that, and I don't want to ignore that, but the science is sort of moving past that, that those, that's still quite viable. It's used, and I totally get it. Art Kaplan, here, though, it's getting into direct manipulation of the genome within the embryo. You know, Marcy looks around and says a lot of countries have laws that don't permit that to go to be put into the germline. We don't, but what matters to our caller's question is if anybody permits it, do we get into an arms race? Do you see that risk, Arthur?
Way, way, way down the road. You know, as we've heard, this is a proof of concept demonstration, very important, but being able to engineer intelligence or greater strength or other properties that might be desirable by some. We're a long, long way from there. We haven't even really shown that you can bear healthy children using the technique. So do I think it's going to be a question? Yes, I do. Do I think we've already seen likely answers to it? I do, not just as an arms race. You look at the people who are trying to get their kids into the right nursery school so they can get into the right college and spending, what, $50,000 a year to
yeah.
do it? Sending them to Kaplan courses,
yeah,
tennis
yeah.
camp, you name it. You can see enhancement in free market competitive societies being seen as a good, not a bad, you know, something you ought to do for your kids.
You mean genetic enhancement one day, you're saying?
Even that too, yes. I could imagine some uses as well. We do enhancement right now to ourselves of a kind of odd genetic variation, which is what vaccination is. We're trying to boost our immune system to be able to be better at fighting off infectious agents.
A little different from getting into our actual genome.
It is, but if you could achieve a powerful immune system and beat back many diseases, not just the ones that are genetic, but the ones that are infectious, I can imagine a fight taking place where people say, look, these kinds of changes are okay, those kinds of changes are not. However, as I said, I still think that's our children's dispute. The current focus still should be on, is the technique ready for use to make any children, or should we demonstrate more in animals? Should we demonstrate more in embryo development? And I think the answers to that are yes. Should we try and get international agreements, not just individual countries, to oversight the technology? I think the answer to that is yes. And, you know, looming out there, too, is the issue of cost. We have access issues. IVF is expensive, whether you're making embryos and screening them or making embryos and trying to repair them.
Who will get to do it and who won't? Who can afford
yeah.
it and who can't?
Exactly. And so a lot of the science that led up to this remarkable demonstration in Oregon was paid for by the taxpayer. You remember we mapped mm-hmm. the genome at great public expense and so on. So are we going to have to pay for it twice?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about editing the human embryo to stave off disease and more. It's now been done in this country. We're asking how far this will and should go. Dr. Paula Amato is with us. She's one of the co-authors of a new study out last week in the journal Nature showing the successful editing of genes in human embryos to repair a common disease-causing mutation, a heart issue. Arthur Kaplan is with us from New York University's School of Medicine, professor of bioethics there. Marcy Darnofsky is with us from the Center for Genetics and Society, raises big questions about this. Before this hour's over, we're going to look at Trump administration moves that would disallow people, that would not allow people to sue nursing homes when residents there feel like they've been abused or mistreated. We'll look at why that's on the table and where that may go. But right now, gene editing. I mean, Dr. Amato, you're in the midst of this, and right away, you know, you hear the arms race worry come up and that somebody will do it and off we'll go. Art Kaplan says that's our children's issue to worry about. That's down the road. But do you see that coming, and do you feel a sufficient ethical conversation going on alongside the kind of research that you and your colleagues are doing?
Absolutely. I think the ethical issues are real and warrant thoughtful discussion. I agree with Dr. Kaplan that that particular concern of a genetics arm race is way down the road. But the point is, anytime there's a new technology, there's always the potential for misuse, whether we're dealing with the medical technology or computer technology or military technology. I think if the reason to pursue it is compelling enough, which in this case, I think it is, to prevent potentially thousands of people from having children that carry horrible genetic diseases, then I think that's sufficient reason to pursue this research despite the risks that we talked about. And we should, I absolutely agree, institute some type of oversights to try and prevent those misuses.
If it went ahead right now, if you'd taken one of these embryos and implanted it in a woman and had gone to term and born, during those months of gestation, what would you have been worried about, Dr. Amato? What could go wrong here?
Well, I think the two main concerns are, did we correct the gene mutation in all the cells in the body? So yeah, it would be hard to know that. Mm-hmm. We could do maybe some additional testing during pregnancy and certainly after pregnancy. And the other issue is that did this gene editing tool, the CRISPR, introduce mutations in other areas of the DNA that would cause potential new problems? So that would be difficult to assess as well. So those are the two main concerns at this point.
Arthur, is that what you're thinking when you say it's way down the road, that when you get in there with your editing tools, you may actually create other problems, that a child could be born with a raft of other things wrong that were introduced in the attempt to repair, to prevent disease?
Yes, and we don't know yet whether that's likely because, even though, again, the experiment's elegant and I think a real proof of concept that this is doable, you've got to really take a number of embryos and get them into adulthood. Let me give you a parallel. Remember when Dolly the sheep was born, we all went crazy and began to worry about clone armies and recreating the dead.
Decades ago now, yeah.
Yeah, but it turned out that cloning introduced different types of biochemical problems, and a lot of the animals that were born weren't healthy. Even Dolly revealed herself to have many ailments later in her life.
Yep.
So that's what you're watching for. You're looking for similar sorts of problems. Do they arise? Do they occur? Which, by the way, gives another immediate ethical obligation, which is to make sure all the studies that are done are registered, that the protocols are transparent so that people know what was done, and that all the bad outcomes, if there are any, are reported too, that people don't squirrel or hide them away. It would be good to have a mandatory international registry.
That sounds like a great idea. I mean, Marcy, you're watching this. Art Kaplan says, you know, real augmentation, genetic human enhancement is years, decades down the road. It's our children's issue. Maybe we've got plenty of time to work out the ethics of this, Marcy.
Well, I think the time to start talking about it and really thinking deeply about it is right now, if not yesterday. And all these safety issues that Paula and Art have just described, I think are reasons very immediately to question why would anyone subject their future child to those risks when you can use embryo screening right now. And the idea that we're going to prevent thousands of people from being born with horrible diseases, as Paula said, I don't see that, because in almost every single case and situation, you can use embryo screening, PGD, to have a child who is unaffected and who is genetically related to both members of a couple. So in the vast majority of cases, we've already got a way to do that. And that's why I think we have to really look at what is the chance that we're going to use this, yes, very technically amazing technique, use it, misuse it, not for medical purposes, but for attempts at enhancement purposes.
I mean, that appetite, if I may, that we know that appetite is very strong, and I've got a little tape I want to play here. This is from the 2016 Vice documentary called Unnatural Selection. Journalist Isabel Young interviews Deborah and Jonathan. Listen to this. This is a couple that chose to undergo the screening. They're already looking for enhancements here. This pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, or PGD. Listen to the conversation.
It sounds like a no-brainer, you know, if you want to be able to test for more diseases and have the healthiest child that you can.
And you also chose to have sex selection, right?
Right.
Yeah, we're picking a girl.
We both want to have a baby girl.
Were there any other traits that you were selecting for that you had the option to select for?
I think we'll be offered eye color.
Well, when we met with Dr. Steinberg, the advances they're making are pretty incredible. We had no idea about eye color, but that is something that he offers.
Boy, I mean, the menu is already out. Art Kaplan, you can hear people, you know, going for enhancement or choice already right there, but maybe that's enough. Just screen and choose, and that's already quite a lot, it sounds like.
Well, it's important to make the point that what Marcy was talking about with screening embryos for diseases could become screening embryos for positive traits, too.
Right there. I mean, they wanted a girl, they'll have a girl. They're choosing for eye color.
Yes, and so the issue is enhancement, not just the technique or whether it's all right to manipulate the embryo. I'm going to repeat what I said again. I think that there are many technologies. It could be artificial intelligence and the robots are going to take us over and destroy us, but we're not throwing our computers out the window right now. You could see brain manipulation with things like deep brain implants to treat Parkinsonism, but you could see us stimulating our brains to become smarter. We're always facing these issues about where to draw the line, what's a limit. I'll say two things. One, if we want to draw a line, I think we can. That's possible. But two, I suspect it's going to be case by case. Boost your immune system, expand your capabilities of perception, maybe. Arguments about, you know, do we want to try and make smarter super people that way? I don't know. So that debate, I don't mind with Marcy having it or beginning the discussion. I don't think it confines to human embryo engineering. It's part of our science intervention type of questions, where the technologies we have will take us. But I wouldn't stop what we're doing now, would not, because I think their disease amelioration is promising.
Hard to imagine humans not reaching for that next thing. Dr. Motto, a century from now, what's your guess? Genetically enhanced humans all over the planet?
I doubt it. I think at least the situation right now is IVF is their access issues, and I don't foresee that this would be widely used by the population at this point.
Well, we are watching. Your research has got everyone's attention. Dr. Paula Amato, professor of obstetrics, gynecology at Oregon Health and Science University, one of the co-authors of this new study. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Amato.
Thank you, everyone.
Marcy,
good to be with you.
Great to have you. Marcy Donofsky at the Center for Genetics and Society, thanks for joining us from California.
Thanks very much.
And Arthur Kaplan from New York University Medical School of Medicine. Art, thanks as always for being here.
Thank you.
In a moment, the fight over the right to sue nursing homes. This is On Point. Yesterday, Senate Democrats called on the Trump administration to protect nursing home residents and their families' right to sue facilities over abuse, neglect, assault. The administration has moved to end an Obama-era rule that prohibited nursing homes that accepted Medicare and Medicaid from including language in resident contracts requiring disputes be settled by a third party rather than a court. They want to knock out that court option there. Joining me now from Washington is Lydia Wheeler, federal regulations reporter for The Hill, who's been following the story. Lydia, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So this was a sort of roundabout way of stopping suits against nursing homes. And how would it work? What are they changing?
That's right. So the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, they want to allow nursing homes to be able to use these provisions, and they're known to lawyers as pre-dispute arbitration agreements. And they said that we want nursing homes to be able to use these so long as they are written in plain language and explained to the prospective resident or their caretaker. And under the rule change, the resident would also be required to acknowledge that they understand what they are signing. But
so in other words, if you want mom or dad to come into this nursing home, you're all going to agree up front that you'll never be able to sue us. We can go to arbitration, but you won't be able to sue us. That's the effect.
That's correct. So this is often a condition of residency. And, you know, consumer and health advocacy groups are saying, hey, this is often an emotional time. This is often a stressful time for the resident, for the elderly, the person that is entering this home and their family, and that they need a place for care. And so they're oftentimes they have to sign this agreement in order to even place their family member in the facility.
Who's been lobbying to get this ability to sue taken away and why?
So there's a group that represents nursing homes known as the American Health Association, and they actually sued after the rule was finalized in October. They claim that the agency had violated its statutory authority, and they say that Congress has repeatedly rejected legislation to invalidate these arbitration agreements. The Supreme Court also has affirmed the use of arbitration agreements, so they claim that, hey, CMS, you shouldn't have issued this rule in October to begin with, and the judge agreed. There was a district court judge in Mississippi that actually blocked the rule in November from taking effect. And now CMS said, okay, we've decided we're going to go back, we're going to reverse this rule because of that court order.
When the Obama administration prohibited nursing homes from cutting off this path to a lawsuit, was there an explosion of lawsuits?
There wasn't, not that I'm aware of, an explosion of lawsuits, but groups are really that are opposed to this, which includes the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, one of the biggest business groups. They actually claim that this is going to increase the cost of nursing home care. So this rule was finalized in October, remember, and then blocked by a court a month later. So there really wasn't that much of an impact because it hadn't even taken effect yet. But they claim that this is really going to increase the cost of nursing home care, and they claim that, arbitration is faster and cheaper, and that there's no actual limit to the monetary award that somebody could receive. But you have to keep in mind that these arbitrators, these third-party people that are chosen to settle these disputes, are often chosen by the company, not the consumer.
And is that right in the language, that when mom or dad or grandma or grandpa are going into the nursing home, does it say right there, you got to go to arbitration and we choose the third-party arbitrator?
That's correct. I believe some of these contracts do stipulate that it's the party's choice. And you have to understand that these agreements are often slipped into the fine print of contracts. And we're not just talking about nursing home contracts. We're talking about all types of consumer contracts. So it could be just if you wanted to get a cell phone or a credit card or a loan. These are kind of tucked into everything.
So the Chamber of Commerce is arguing that this would make nursing home care more expensive. What's the argument from those who want to sustain the right to sue?
Right. So the consumer and health advocacy groups that are fighting this, there's more than 75 groups that have joined forces to form this Fair Arbitration Now coalition to stop CMS from reversing this rule. And those include groups like Public Citizen and AARP. They claim that this is really an unfair rule and that it creates an unequal balance of power, putting nursing homes above the consumer. They argue that this prevents residents from being able to take facilities to court to settle disputes over everything. We're talking about alleged abuse, neglect, sexual assault, even wrongful death.
So what percentage of nursing homes take Medicare and Medicaid? Is most of them, so almost all of them would be affected by this?
there's a large majority of facilities that accept Medicaid and Medicare funds for their patients. So this would really impact a large swath of facilities.
I mean, over the years, we've heard some pretty horrific stories coming out of the realm of nursing homes about the way elders or those with disabilities were treated when they were in there. Does this lower the fear that nursing homes have? Does it make them maybe less attentive to the needs or even less attentive to the possibility of abuse going on?
I think that's certainly a concern of the consumer and health advocacy groups. And what they're really concerned about, too, is that sometimes these arbitration agreements dictate that you can't discuss what was discussed in arbitration, that these consumers and these families can't go to the media or can't even talk to other residents or other residents' family to see if there's a similar type of abuse or neglect happening so that they could maybe possibly form a class action lawsuit. So these arbitration agreements are really restrictive in that sense.
So this is a very industry-friendly move. I mean, the nursing home industry must love this.
That's correct. That they had little to say to me when I called them for the story, pointing me back to their comments in 2015 when they were actually fighting the rule that banned the use of these agreements. But yeah, it would seem to me that they're pretty pleased that the administration is taking a turnaround on this.
When complaints are brought, are these arbitrators giving settlements to those who have suffered abuse that are sufficient in size to make the nursing homes clean up their acts, Lydia?
The nursing homes claim that they are. These business groups say, hey, there's actually no limit to the monetary size of awards. But you have to understand that in arbitration, there is no judge, there's no jury, there's no right to an appeal. So if they're not the right size, if residents don't feel like they got what they deserve or there's no repercussion for them to argue, the result.
The Trump administration looking to move the needle toward the nursing home industry when it comes to what kind of outcome there may be when someone in a nursing home has been abused or mistreated. Lydia Wheeler is covering all this for The Hill and joined us today from Washington. Lydia, thank you very much for your up-to-date reporting on this. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.